Wisconsin, I is in Milwaukee at the State Republican Party Convention, visiting with 8th District Congressman Mike Gallagher. Mike, thanks for stopping in.
Thanks for having me. How are you, sir?
You're finishing your first term.
Yes.
Lessons learned at a tumultuous, historic time in Washington. Lessons learned the first term?
Yeah. So I think I underestimated how divisive the current moment is and how difficult it is to get anything done in D.C. And we could talk about why I think that is. But I think particularly for the newer members, and I've actually been really blown away by the quality of my freshman class. On both sides of the aisle, we have a lot of kind of independent thinkers, people that recognize that politics as usual isn't really working out well for either party. But it's so hard to disrupt or challenge the status quo. And I think social media has made the environment a little bit worse for everybody. So a lot of times I just want to have a conversation with people and everyone, you know, just say, what's working, what isn't, what do you think? And instead everyone just starts yelling at each other. And so I think that's something we all need to think about and probably spend less time online and more time just talking with each other face to face.
You younger members of Congress want to make progress and remove some of the dysfunction.
Yeah.
Other than getting everybody to put down their cell phones and get off social media, what realistically can you do to make some progress?
Sure. So we actually just had a remarkable meeting with the president, and it was three freshman Democrats, three freshman Republicans, and we were all trying to get his support for term limits. An old idea, I know, so it's not necessarily that innovative, but we all believe that that would change the incentive structure in Congress and get past this endless careerism and endless campaigning that we see. And I do think that really infects all of politics today, makes it very difficult to get anything done. And he supported the effort, tweeted about it afterwards, and now we're all working together, and that's something that resonates with 80% of the American people on both sides of the aisle. It's not a silver bullet solution. I think there's more you'd have to do. I've proposed ending congressional pension, having a 5-year, if not a lifetime, ban on lobbying for former members of Congress. And then there's some less sexy things that I think you could do in terms of how the House operates. For example, keep us there for 3 weeks straight, force us to work 6 or 7 day work weeks, and then give people a week back at home so people aren't flying back and forth constantly.
On Monday and Friday.
Exactly. Or keep us locked in the House chamber until we actually have a debate about, take your pick, if it's immigration or whatever issue. Part of the thing that really frustrates me as a new member is, you know, everyone talks about, we got to do this, got to do this, and then everyone goes home, and then the debate remains unresolved, and the problems just get worse and worse over time. And I see among the newer members people that are willing to take risk, willing to ride to the sound of the guns, and take tough votes, even if it costs them politically. And so I think we got to figure out, how do we make the institution function again, and at the very least debate some of these problems, as opposed to people just acting like pundits and going on TV and yelling at each other.
Do you wish the president wouldn't fire cabinet secretaries and do so much by tweeting?
Well, I've said, I think, on record that Twitter's making everybody stupid, myself included, so I think we should all spend less time on it. Now, it will be said, I mean, it's a huge tool that he has in his arsenal to bypass traditional media channels, and there's certainly people that disagree with me and say that it can be productive. Maybe I'm old school. I sort of will always like the Reagan model of delivering inspiring point du jour speeches and fireside chats and things like that, but this is the new reality with media, and I myself am struggling with how to use it to communicate effectively with my constituents. But notwithstanding all the noise and all the news stories you hear every single day about who's on the in and who's on the out in the administration, I think there's some actual good things that are happening on the ground, and I try and look at outcomes and not obsess over what the sort of crisis of the day is, or whatever, what I call the us weeklyization of American politics, where instead of policy, we think about, well, what is Hope Hicks or Melania wearing today, or who's in favor and who's out of it. And so I try and stay focused on substance. The only thing I can control is my own behavior, and I try and conduct myself with integrity and at least be honest about what I feel and want.
What do you consider your biggest victory for the 8th District in your first term, Congressman? Yeah,
something that doesn't get reported a lot but affects everybody, not just in the 8th District, but certainly us especially, because we're a huge part of our defense industrial backbone, is the military rebuild that we've started. This past week we had an all-day and all-night session of the Armed Services Committee to pass the National Defense Authorization Act, which will be the second year of a two-year military rebuild after 6 years of devastating defense cuts, which has really jeopardized our safety, and that's why we're seeing ships crash into commercial vessels, that's why we're seeing helicopters fall out of the sky. We're finally turning that around. And we take that for granted, right? We send 18 and 19-year-old kids downrange to keep us safe, that give us the luxury of coming here and arguing peacefully. We owe them our best. We should never send them into a fair fight. And that's what I spent a lot of time working on the Armed Services Committee. I think tax reform was an accomplishment. We certainly improved the status quo, and we've heard a lot of good news stories. In my neck of the woods, for example, Associated Bank gave about 800 of their employees a raise. They raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. To certain people like Nancy Pelosi, that may not seem like a lot, but that ends up being $4,000 a year extra for a Wisconsin family making less than 60 grand a year. That's meaningful. A lot of work yet to be done in health care reform. I know that's divisive. Immigration, take your pick. And again, that's why I spend a lot of time focused on process-oriented reforms, congressional reform, draining the swamp. But even with something as divisive as healthcare, I paired with a Democrat from Colorado, and we're trying to push this effort on price transparency. So even on the more intractable issues, I try and carve out a little area where I think I can move the ball forward, even as a freshman in college.
Well, when you were in the military, your specialty was intelligence. You were on General Petraeus's staff.
A lot of people say Marine Corps intelligence is a contradiction in terms. I don't know what they're talking about, though. I don't know if that's an insult.
I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. So let's talk about hotspot areas. Yes. Do you trust North Korea?
I do not trust North Korea. I think the administration, however, has the right approach. The policy of maximum pressure is the right one, abandoning 25 years of failed policy. Also, I think we've learned the right lessons in terms of, for example, our diplomacy is meaningless unless it's backed by the credible threat of military force. And I do think by striking in areas like Syria, by taking a more aggressive posture, we've enhanced our diplomatic credibility in Asia. Now, that being said, if you look at the history of these negotiations, the Koreans have lied time and again. Kim Jong-un, certainly his father, consistently agree to certain things and then they violate. For example, in the Clinton administration, they agreed to halt activity on the plutonium track and covertly advance their program on the uranium track. And so we have to be very skeptical. When they talk about denuclearization, they're talking about different things than we're talking about. We're really talking about dismantlement. Kim Jong-un means something totally different. And in South Korea, we have a government that's desperate to make a deal right now. So that being said, while I am skeptical, I think we should give Kim Jong-un every opportunity to prove my skepticism wrong. And I'm confident that, you know, guys like John Bolton and Pompeo and Nikki Haley aren't going to agree to a deal that's not in our interests.
So, do you support the president's meeting June 12th?
Sure. We'll see where it leads. Quite honestly, looking at history, I doubt Kim Jong-un's going to come to that table and say, you know what, I'm going to give up my nuclear program entirely. You can land your C-130s and we can get rid of all the equipment and then we can unite the Korean Peninsula. This is a government that doesn't even recognize the existence of South Korea. So this would be an entire sea change. So I'm skeptical, but I do think we wouldn't have this opportunity, as small as I think it might be, were it not for the administration putting pressure on the North Koreans and the Chinese. My only hope, and they've recently said things that have reassured me, is that we don't let up that pressure while we are exploring the diplomatic option. We've only begun to scratch the surface in terms of the economic pressure we can put on not only the North Koreans, but secondary sanctions on Chinese businesses. And so we have to keep that pressure going. And if they're not serious, this should be a pretty short conversation. We should be able to determine their intentions pretty quickly, and we'll just have to reimpose or enhance pressure if they're not serious.
The New York Times story that said that the North Korea has its nuclear weaponry in miles of tunnels throughout their entire country. Do you think there would be any effective way to monitor any promise by North Korea that we are indeed getting rid of our nukes?
It makes it extraordinarily difficult, and that's what we have to have under any deal that would emerge. Very onerous inspection requirements, full access by the IAEA, and it also means what I talked about earlier with the military rebuild. What's in demand around the world right now are what are called ISR assets, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, so ways where you can use aerial surveillance, communication surveillance, and intercepts in order to determine what our enemies are doing. And so it's going to take, even in a peaceful solution, right, where we avoid conflict on the Korean Peninsula, it's going to take an enormous surge of American power and our allies' power and commitment to really verify if the North Koreans are abiding by any agreement. And I think our approach in this should be distrust and verify, and maybe trust a couple decades in the future. But to your point, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult. And you think about, should there be a kinetic option? I mean, you have thousands of pieces of artillery that are dug into the Kaesong Heights right across 35 miles from Seoul. Seoul's the second largest metropolitan area in the world. Should we find ourselves in a conflict, it's going to get really messy really quickly. And we have to be clear-eyed about what we're doing here.
Given your intelligence background, was the president right to pull out of the Iran deal?
I think absolutely he was right to get out of the Iran deal. Listen, the Iran deal provided a pathway for the Iranian regime to have an industrial scale nuclear capability in less than 15 years. The smartest thing they could do is just abide by the deal because it's extraordinarily generous for them. It also undermines our broader non-proliferation policy around the world. For example, when our allies seek to gain access to nuclear technology that U.S. companies make, we make them sign things called the 123 agreements. And we make them forswear enriching domestically on their soil. We allow the Iranians up front to have the right of domestic enrichment and therefore undermined all of our deals and our nonproliferation policy around the world. I also think the premise of the deal, which was basically that there were reformers in the regime and that by getting them hooked on cash, we could elevate the status of the reformers relative to the hardliners. Well, I think since the deal, we've seen exactly the opposite. Iran's behavior in the region has gotten more aggressive, more destructive. Its support for terrorism, its development of ballistic missiles, which were left out of the deal, has gotten worse. And so while this may require some uncomfortable conversations with our allies right now, this is the right move.
The stalemate in Afghanistan, yeah. Our generals have said a stalemate. What should we do in the future there?
Well, I think I was in Afghanistan over Christmas and spoke with all our military leaders on the ground, and they all express support and optimism around the new South Asia strategy. Now, there's a tendency among, you know, us military folks to say we can get the job done no matter what the obstacles are. And so we in Congress need to continually monitor the war effort. But the big pieces of the strategy, I think, are right. And there's been some changes, right? One, we've devolved more authority to commanders on the ground so that they can make targeting decisions at a quicker pace, and that's having an effect on the battlefield already. Two, we're learning some lessons in terms of how we've trained the Afghan National Army in the past. And then three, taking a tougher approach on Pakistan, I think, is absolutely essential. I mean, insurgencies survive because they have external safe haven and support, and this insurgency is no different. And until we crack down on Pakistan, we're really going to be fighting an endless war. So I think there's enough there in terms of a new approach that should we should be willing to test this new approach. But I plan to return every year and monitor this effort. And I think we need to be honest, if we don't see a change, particularly after this next fighting season, we have to ask hard questions about what are our interests and what are we willing to sacrifice in order to maintain a persistent presence in Afghanistan.
Members of the House GOP caucus are threatening to force a vote on DACA. Wise move?
I think we should have the debate. I mean, I'm not a fan of these discharge.
You haven't
petitions.
Signed on to the discharge.
I haven't signed on to the discharge. But as I mentioned before, I'm extraordinarily frustrated by the fact that we have, you know, there's a mini crisis and then everyone goes home and then nothing happens. And I actually thought that the White House's proposal on immigration was a good one. And it was pretty generous on when it came to DACA. And I thought maybe that would bring some of the Democrats into the conversation. Obviously, the Senate had a series of votes that didn't go anywhere. But I think if we're not going to do that, we have a responsibility to put at least a bill on the floor. I would prefer the good lad effort, and they are continuing to whip that bill. It's not perfect, but it at least would start a debate. And let's see what happens. Let's put everyone on the record in terms of whether they're willing to actually fix this issue or if they really want to just use it to demagogue or as a wedge in an election year, which I fear that some people, and maybe on both sides, want to do that.
President Trump has said, I might shut down the government if I don't get that border wall. You've heard all the debate on the border wall.
Yeah.
Support it?
Yeah. I think anyone who's been to the southern border, as I have, I worked in the Drug Enforcement Agency in their Special Ops Division, and we did counter-narcotics on the southern border, knows that we do not have operational control of the southern border. Now, there are areas, it's divided into nine sectors, where you want a physical barrier. There are areas, perhaps, in the less populated, where you can use sensors, technologies. We passed, after a year of work in the Homeland Security Committee, a comprehensive border security bill, because it's not just a physical barrier, it's sensors, as I mentioned, but it's also people. And so we talked with the DHS secretary and everybody that's down there, the Border Patrol agents. We said, what do you guys need to actually do this in a smart and cost-effective way? So to get started, we're going to need anywhere between, you know, $10 to $20 billion. But I think there's a smart path forward on border security. And I think we also have to recognize, though, that the majority of people in this country aren't coming here illegally by crossing the Rio Grande in the dead of the night. They're overstaying their visas. So if you could somehow construct a physical barrier that keeps everyone out, we'd still have a massive illegal immigration problem. So it's got to be a comprehensive approach. You got to have a defense in depth. You got to be willing to enforce the law as well. And I think if we do that and we can accept the president's proposal on DACA, to me, maybe I'm crazy, but I feel like there's enough there for both sides to get to yes. And what I hear more than anything else from people in Northeast Wisconsin, they don't expect you to agree with them 100%. I know this issue is divisive. It's just we want you guys to fix some problems, get some stuff done. And so I hope as difficult as it is in an election year, we can at least continue to have the debate.
Final question. The president's defenders, including Kellyanne Conway, Anthony Scaramucci, said, look, news media, the American public is more interested in his international progress with North Korea, good signs,
yeah,
and the economy than these personal issues, without mentioning any names. Do you hear that from residents of the 8th District?
I do. I do a lot. I mean, I think, the history of our country has been filled with, flawed people. All of us in public office are flawed, and we expect our public leaders not to be perfect, but to advance the cause on certain issues, and we want to have a debate and a disagreement. And so, I don't know. Like I said before, what people tell me more than anything else is just stop yelling at each other, stop with the Us Weekly stuff, and let's just get some stuff done. They want results at the end of the day, economically and in foreign policy. And so I try and stay focused on results. I do try and conduct myself in a way that people can be proud of my behavior in office. But more than anything else, I just try and work hard and get stuff done.
Congressman Mike Gallagher.
Thank you.
Thanks for talking to Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
Thank you.